Well, hello everyone. Welcome to Drive to Win. I'm Justin Bell here in the Wynn Las Vegas, and the show is brought to you by Mobile One for the love of driving. Well, what a weekend at Silverstone for the British Grand Prix. Basically, my entire Saturday, Sunday was spent watching what was, for me, my home race, but also just one of the finest spectacles in world motorsport. It was just incredible from start to finish. British weather, of course, bringing what it does, which is pretty much a damner on anyone's party. But it didn't stop the festivities, as you saw. I think 70,000 Brits were camping there. I tell you, it's pretty dire. The water coming down, covered in mud. But when they got to the grandstands to watch, it was worth every bit of that sacrifice. On today's show, I have Ruth Buscombe joining me. She is the former Formula One strategist, who now is one of the analysts on F1 TV and my new favorite broadcaster because she brings such insight. Can't wait to talk to her. Well, we had our sixth different winner in 2024. What a difference a year makes. And it certainly is bringing the excitement to Formula One that it's so sorely needed. And you can see that reflected in the fans. Now, we have a very partisan crowd in the UK. They love their British home hero. But this time we had three of them on the front two rows, which was quite outstanding. And you can see the way everyone responded. Lewis Hamilton, of course, an eight-time winner at that race, became a nine-time winner, which basically sent everyone off into such a frenzy that there's something that the British fans do, as well as the Dutch, as well as the Italians. They get behind their driver and they blow the roof off the building. So it was incredible. As you'd imagine, the Formula One grid, the pre-grid, was as celebrity-packed as ever. And Gordon Ramsay, Brad Pitt there promoting the new movie, which we saw a little trailer for. It's going to be very cool. Michael Douglas, Rowan Atkinson, Gordon Ramsay, so many other people joined that just to make that the place to be. The epicenter of sort of social media activity worldwide was on the Formula One grid this weekend. Loved it. Now, of course, that British weather brought in a lot of variables, which we saw play out not just in the practice, but in qualifying and then in the race. And you know, as I think I'm going to get into with Ruth a bit later, it does add an element of surprise. The strategists have to work harder than ever at that point. But three Brits on those front two rows, it couldn't have been more exciting. And the race was as good as I think anyone could have predicted when you have all those elements. It was about rivalry. I mean, seeing Norris and Verstappen after their, you know, tete-a-tete, which they had in the last race, they obviously spent some time together, talked it through. It is possible, it appears, to be great friends off track and intense mano-a-mano rivals on the track. We had the inter-team rivalry. Just look at the way Mercedes and McLaren are operating. Passing, we had those incredible passes. Now remember, the DRS speed advantage down hangar straight is so outrageous that if you're within the 1 second, you basically pass the guy in front with barely resistance. And we saw that as Lando went past the Max in the Red Bull. It almost looked too easy, but it's pretty hard to defend. It was about strategy. It was about the softs, the mediums, the hards. Some people used too many in practice and qualifying. They didn't have the ideal tire choice for the race. But what will be the faster tire of the final run? It might be the unexpected one, like Max with the hard. Bad calls, good calls. I mean, we saw McLaren totally step on their little orange foot, and they went from potentially winning the race, certainly being 1-2 with both cars, to pretty much shuffling them to the back of the podium and beyond. But in the end, what a podium. Just to see Lewis, his ninth win at Silverstone, his 199th podium and 104 wins. I mean, he is the GOAT. He is our Tom Brady. And just to see the way he responded, and especially after the race, to see the insight, the very emotional insight from him on just what his personal journey has been to stay at the top, working with Bono, his engineer, and just keeping that team together. And a bittersweet moment, the last time he will ever race for that Mercedes brand at Silverstone in front of his home crowd. But I'm sure the management at Ferrari were pretty happy. And Max Verstappen, he didn't win. But in many ways, the analysts and the historians on Formula One will say that was one of his best races. A few more laps, he might have pulled it off. He was able to control the race, his race from inside the car, making the call in collaboration with Bono, his engineer, and he absolutely nailed it. He went on a tire choice that I went, that's just ridiculous. Why are you putting hards on for the end? But it almost proved totally right. Lando Norris rounded out the top three. He was totally annoyed at himself, disappointed. Now he knows that he can win races. I think he knows that he has to deliver. And that's really the apex of this conversation today is, in order to beat Red Bull, yes, you can have an anomaly of a weekend when everything comes right for you and they have maybe something not go quite so right. But if you want to win and beat them every weekend, every element of the team has to perform at an exceptional level above the norm. And I think that's what we're seeing. But Lando, he will win again before the end of the year. This was a race that set the stage for the rest of the year, and I cannot wait to talk to our guests. So that'll be just in a minute. Ultimate Race Week at the Wynn Las Vegas is back, and just in time for you to make plans to attend the 2024 Heineken Las Vegas Grand Prix. The racing on the track last November was indeed electric, with a whopping 82 overtakes, and race fans that stayed here at the Wynn Las Vegas are treated to a best-in-class Formula One hospitality experience like no other. There are multiple packages, all with different price points, available for purchase now at WynnLasVegas.com. The Grand Fan Package covers three nights of accommodations right here at Wynn Las Vegas, along with two F1 grandstand tickets and access to exclusive special events and amenities. The Wynn Grid Club Package allows you to watch the race from the second floor of the paddock, right above pit lane. This ultra-exclusive hospitality suite features up-close views of turns one and two from a private outdoor terrace. It includes five-star dining and beverages and a three-night stay in either a Wynn or Encore Tower suite. To make your ultimate race week reservations today, head to WynnLasVegas.com. That's WynnLasVegas.com. Don't miss out, as last year's race was incredible, and this year promises to be even better. Well, now it's time to introduce my guest, Ruth Buscombe. I'm going to quote directly from her Wikipedia page right now, but she is a British motorsports engineer and presenter for F1 TV. That's how I got to know her. A first-class honors graduate of the University of Cambridge Department of Engineering. She began working in Formula One with Ferrari at its headquarters in 2012 as a race strategist. She later moved to Haas Formula One team, and in November 2015 became the team's strategy engineer. She left Haas in 2016, went to Sauber, and then joined the F1 TV lineup mid-2024 from her role as strategy engineer at the Stake F1 team Kick Sauber. Couldn't be more excited, feeling a little intellectually inferior. Ruth, welcome to Drive to Win. So nice to meet you, even virtually.
Lovely to meet you too.
Yeah, it was such a refreshing thing when you came onto the broadcast, because I really like F1 TV. I like watching on the app because I can do it from anywhere. So I've become I don't think I've watched the other side of the broadcast for months. So it was really fun. And just to see you evolve over the over this period of time, are you really enjoying it?
Yeah, it's phenomenal. It's so nice to be able to be part of the F1 family, both what you guys get to see home and also working with the guys back in our kind of factory. I keep saying factory, actually, it's like a broadcast studio. A lifetime of working in teams for you, kind of making sure that we're bringing lots of kind of data to you guys at home because, I'm a bit of a geek. So it's nice to be able to see some of the kind of plots that teams kind of see. I'm now putting those out on the broadcast as well.
Yeah, well, that's what I keep thinking, especially when I read what your education, and I'm thinking she must have been that really cool, geeky girl that all the guys just couldn't get their head around, that she's into cars, she's into aerodynamics, you're into data. And, it's maybe the most intimidating thing for anyone else, especially in racing, because the drivers are, as you know, most drivers, however bright they are, their education normally, formal education is sadly lacking, right? They just cart and they get in and they get to where you are, where they get in the career. And then they have someone like you come in who is, has all that academic side. And I was thinking the marriage, when you first went into racing, seeing how the practical side relates to the theoretical, must have been, was that a really eye-opening moment for you when the two collided?
Yeah, definitely. I think strategy is 50% maths and 50% communication. And if you're only good at half of it, you tend to end up, you know, on kind of hard tires in the rain. So it's a kind of about like making sure you get the numbers right, but then also explaining it. And the way that you explain a race strategy is very different to a bunch of engineers that have got 45 minutes to go into like every single detail and you're kind of using all the numbers versus, you know, to a driver that doesn't have as much time. They're getting a lot of information across a race weekend from various different sources. And indeed, your kind of management, your team principles. So it's kind of one of the exciting parts that I like about race strategy is that you have both different ways and different audiences. And then it all changes again during a race where actually you need to make sure that you're making decisions quickly and then communicating those decisions effectively and kind of in a time limit. So that's what I like about it. Pressure is a privilege.
That's a great way of putting it. Pressure is a privilege. But also, I remember, I mean, I did a lot of the IMSA, it's broadcasting here in Le Mans and everything. And that's what I did for 10 years after my racing. And I was, you know, you get constantly told by your producer, even with my basic understanding of things, you know, make it relevant and make it understandable for the audience. Don't overcomplicate it that you alienate the casual fans, and don't undercomplicate it that you insult the guys that have a lot of knowledge watching, guys and girls. I'm sure that's the same for you, right? Because you could explode with this smorgasbord of intellectual insight and everything that's going on. But actually, you have to distill it down to the fewest number of words, whether it's with a team, a driver, or on the broadcast. Is that a part of the challenge that you're really enjoying?
Yeah, it is. And actually, that bit is kind of the bit that you've practiced really for the last 13 years, because that's exactly what we have to do in a race when we're in a team, is to say, you know, you could go into a kind of, you know, soliloquy about why exactly the hard tire is going to work at this temperature and the other temperature is not going to be, and then you're going to have an insert. Whereas actually, you need to kind of give clear instructions and have kind of created like kind of chains of command. So a lot of the time when we're actually in sessions, we kind of operate a bit more like kind of like a military unit, where you have kind of like, you know, lines of command, and you kind of don't discuss things exactly as you say, because that's kind of for post the session, where you can kind of understand why you made a good decision or a bad decision. But actually making no decision because you're too busy explaining why it's such a great idea and not actually doing the idea is the worst of all the options available.
I'm sure it is. Yeah, I mean, especially the amount of data that you guys process. And we'll come back to that in a minute. First of all, let's talk about the British Grand Prix, just through the TV screen. Obviously, I've been there so many times, but just feeling that energy, the crowd, the atmosphere. Tell me about the weekend from the other side of it, the emotional side, because it was mind-blowing from here.
I mean, like Silverstone is always, you always get rained on. It's always kind of miserable British summer. And you're like, why do I come here every year? Like, this is just, I'm just going to skip this one next year. And then without a doubt, every blooming Sunday, it ends up being this like ridiculously amazing race. And you're like, oh, I love it. I love this place after all. And what a race we had. I mean, you know, Sir Lewis Hamilton winning for a record 9th time after, you know, nearly 1,000 days without a race win. And, you know, a lot of us within the paddock kind of, you know, grew up with Lewis around. And, you know, like the one thing is it is a traveling circus, and we are like friends with friends with all these guys. And, you know, we've seen them in their highs and in their lows. And, you know, like I remember chatting to him a couple of months ago. I know he's like, you know, you're gonna like win. It's gonna be great. And he's like, really? Yeah, of course you are. So you know, it was nice for him to, you know, not only win in such amazing fashion, but be able to do it on his last go with Mercedes, and in front of the home crowd at Silverstone, because it's one of the few tracks that when we get a British winner, I remember as a kid being there as a fan, and then as an adult working there, you could actually hear the car go round the kind of, you know, 3.5 mile-ish, if I'm converting it to American, circuit, because you can hear the roar of the crowd from sitting in the kind of the pit wall. You can hear as the car comes around. So it was so special to see that. So special for his dad, Anthony, there. Like, you know, and you were just, yeah, absolutely amazing. Obviously, you know, he's producer on the new F1 movie that, you know, all of us in Formula One so excited to have. You know, filming there as well. So he had all his movie mates as well, where everybody to see him. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like it said it all that actually, you know, Max, Lando, everyone, despite them, you know, obviously everyone wants to win, you know, the sportsmanship in that cool down room, that everybody was just really happy for Lewis to actually like win at Silverstone. Says all you need to know about Lewis and all about the sportsmanship that actually really truly does define the sport behind closed doors, is that everybody is really genuinely proud of other people's you know, success. And that's what sportsmanship is about, like the fiercest competition on track and the kind of, you know, closest family off track.
And my dad was in the BRDC and he said you didn't even need to see the monitor to know when an overtake happened with Lewis.
Yeah,
you just heard it.
Yeah, it's right? Always the way.
And he is definitely...
Yeah, I love tracks like that.
It is crazy.
It's actually super useful.
It is probably useful, right? Especially in your job. Did
Yeah, like Zandvoort, you can tell who's leading into turn one, Monza, all these ones, Monaco. Whenever it's a home race, you know, it's quite useful on a pit wall because, you know, you can actually put your attention on something else because you'll get the answer of what's happened at the front from the crowd.
So let's talk about the race because for me, I just actually this morning rewatched the 30 minute cut down that you guys do, you know, which is quite helpful. Just to rewatch it because I just wanted to confirm to myself those laps from 19 to 29, when, you know, Lewis took George, then Norris takes them both, and then Piastri, and then, you know, George falls out, you know, gets withdrawn, and then Max comes through, and McLaren hold on to Piastri, you know, like a lap too late, and then Piastri is held out. I'm thinking for you as a strategist, that 10-lap window, including the weather, which was so, you know, combustible in a way and threw the grenade in amongst everybody, for you, is that almost the most dynamic environment that you could ever have in a race?
I think as a, you know, as a fan, yes, as a strategist, actually, you know, it's just a series of kind of building blocks and decisions and, you know, bearing in mind, we are like putting our entire lives into this. So yeah. Like, you know, we kind of, you know, you have information, but it's not just like you start the race, you know, like we have very accurate weather radars that are available to all teams that F1 provides. You know, so that first, you know, like blip of rain, you could see the lap times going up and then going back down again. So actually... given the fact that you knew that little window of rain was only 5 minutes and the wettest it got cost you about 10 seconds, even if you kind of add up the seconds, it was never going to be like 40 seconds, which is how much it costs to get onto the wet tire and then back off to it, which is kind of why the teams made that decision. And then the second rain was big rain, and it was kind of like not a case of if, but when it comes to getting on the tire. And then the same with the kind of the crossover. One of the really special things about tracks is that you have like a lap time crossover, but then you also have like a limit. So it's always been the same limit at Silverstone, just by the layout of the track. So between turn 15 and 18 is always the bit that dries the last, which means you get great, exciting racing because pretty much 95% of the track is ready. You're just waiting for these like last couple of corners. And then the second that they go, when you put on a tire, you go much, much, much faster on a slick. And then you kind of go into the compounds and... Actually, you know, people said that, you know, Checo didn't help as a teammate, but he did run the hard at the beginning of the race and was the only driver to actually run that hard tire. And of course, Red Bull had that data that helped them make the decision in terms of fitting that hard tire at the end of the race. There was a couple of guys on the soft and you could see already the difference between Ocon and Joe in terms of degradation. We had a similar thing on the Friday with that soft tire that was so robust last year. Actually was struggling a bit with the conditions we had on graining. So even though it seems kind of like a total mess, as a strategist, you kind of like go down and look at the building blocks and understand kind of, you know, what's correlation and what's causality, what's causing what, to try to, you know, as a strategy group, do your job of making the best decisions, or as a strategist and the broadcast, do our job of trying to inform you guys what's going on. At the time, I did at one point get very excited and say box now to my producer because I defaulted to type rather than saying this is when the crossover is, so you should be looking forward to it. So then it did feel like I boxed Max Verstappen at one point because he then duly came in, so that was good.
That's exactly what I'm talking about, because you have all that knowledge from all those years of actually doing it, but also only doing it for the one team, right? For your car on the pit wall, the people that pay you, while you're analyzing as best you can what everyone else is doing, which I'm sure is a big part of your pre-race strategy meetings. But in what you're doing now, you're able to be the ultimate armchair coordinator, aren't you? The ultimate armchair strategist, and watch what everyone is doing. So I'm sure there's moments when you go, yeah, I would have pitted Max then. And then equally, what the heck when they're holding Piastri out, right? Your head must be spinning.
Yeah, I mean, it is nice to be able to kind of, you know, always follow the most exciting story, because obviously by being in a team, you know, it's not always your car that's doing the most exciting story. At the same time, you do miss things like, you know, you kind of like used to kind of get like asking, oh, can we get the wear scan from the first stint? And then it's like, no, we're of sport. We don't have a wear scan from the first stint. You have to go and like run down and actually see what the tyres are like. So, yeah, you do have different information than you would if you were in the team. Where we have all the telemetry, so you can see the temperature of the tires, you can see things like that. But you know, we try and do the best we can with the information we have. Champions adjust.
Great quote. When you are calling the strategy, and I mean, it was interesting on the TV. You talked about like 108%, 112%. You know, when you get to that, can you just for our viewers and fans explain that when the lap times drop to a certain percentage, then you know mathematically they're in the right window?
Yeah, so we, for rainy conditions, we tend to talk in percentages because the crossover, which is the point at which you are the same pace on a slick tire as you are on those green inters, or there's a crossover where you're the same pace on the inter to the X wet, is broadly about the same percentage everywhere-ish. Okay. But obviously the lap times are very, very different depending on how much fuel you have in the car, whether it's a short track, whether it's a long track. So first off, we're talking percentages. So if you imagine that if you were running normally in the race on a brand new slick tire, so like a soft or a medium, you'd be going about 100%, which is your reference, so 0% more than you think. But then when you slow down, you're going an extra 10 or 12%. When it gets to the point that there's so much rain that you're driving around on a slick tire and you're going 10 to 12% slower than you would do normally, is about the point, now there's nuances, about the point, whereas if you swap to a green one and inter, you would go faster. Okay. So that's what the crossover is. And that's usually a good rule of thumb. Then you have to check lots of other things in terms of, as we say, like, is there like a limiting corner? Is there just like a big old wet patch where you're going to like fall off, in which case you'd have to be on it sooner. So these crossovers are really important, and you can actually see the lap times go, and normally they go in a parabola, right? So they start small, so it's one lap, you kind of, just because rain, like it's a cloud, right? So it starts a little bit and then it gets a lot, and then it usually goes. So, you know, if you imagine kind of you have a cloud where it's wettest in the middle and a little bit at the end and a little bit at the beginning, that's the same thing that happens with the lap time. So the first lap, it doesn't change it much. It goes 1 or 2%, which actually at Silverstone, the maths is super easy because the lap is nearly 100 seconds. So you could just think about it in seconds, yeah, actually there. And then the next lap, it might be 4%, but then the next lap, it will be 10%. And then if you, the Piastri one is, it goes up to 100, and like, so then you're suddenly, you're kind of jumping up. So it is about kind of understanding and correlating what a rain cloud means to lap times, if that makes sense, which, yeah, is, you do that both through experience at that track, and actually, you know, the way to get the crossover for the second load of rain was just to copy the numbers from the first load of rain, because actually it was exactly the same. So there's a lot of kind of, yeah, nuances that at home, we had the same thing in qualifying. If you just looked at it, you just go, it's raining. But actually, in terms of the sensitivity to lap times, it's massively, massively sensitive. And there's a whole amount of a wet track where it's way quicker on a slick tire, which is a bit confusing. But yeah, up to the point that you're kind of going 10, 12 seconds a lap slower, it's faster just a little bit slower on a slick tire than to put on an inter. And then you've got to remember, if you're getting on an inter, you've got to get back off it. And each time you change tires at Silverstone, it costs you 20 seconds. So it's a lot of maths, but quite fun.
Yeah, well, it's fun for you. But I've been on the other end of it when I've been in the car, and they will come on the radio and say, can you stay out? And you heard that being asked of all the top drivers, because those are the only radio transmissions we hear generally. But, you know, how are you going to stay out? Can you stay out? Can you manage it? That, I'll tell you, from a driver's point of view, is the most intense question you can ever have. Because, you know, part of you, the bravado, is like, of course I can. And then you also know if you pitch it off into the gravel, you've just gone from hero to zero. it's interesting to hear how some drivers have an innate confidence in their ability in that. And you hear them, like Max will just say no, or Norris, I want to do this. What driver really impresses you with their ability to control things from the car?
I mean, many of them. Statistically, because I'm a numbers gal, Max has always been very strong at that, which I think is because he's Dutch. So, you know, he's been growing up in like lots of like wet countries, learn normally it's actually the kids that learn how to drive in the rain that end up being pretty good, which is why Lewis as well, obviously, you know, had the car hasn't been the fastest the last couple of years, but people like Max and Lewis are typically, you know, very strong in those conditions. And as you say, it really depends on the driver. Like we have whole databases as teams of which drivers are cautious and which drivers are aggressive and which drivers are kind of Goldilocks and in the middle, so that when we hear a competitor simple, you know, like even though I've never done strategy for Max, I know exactly when he went in Hockenheim in 2019, for example, and I'll use that as a reference when I hear that radio to correlate to where I think our car will each have less downforce potentially, so it's slightly later for us. So you do get to know kind of the driver's reference, and so do the engineers. So like, you know, when you have a driver, if you have one driver that, as you say, is super like, yeah, I can do this, and then they always crash, you would probably put a little bit of extra margin on, and vice versa. If there's one that's a little bit, you know, actually they don't enjoy it, but they are faster, you probably kind of gently, or not so gently, if it's me, nudge them and go, nah, mate, like it's 5 seconds a lap faster on the intertie. You want to go onto it now, or vice versa. So you kind of, you know, as with every sports person, you want to get the most out of them, you know, like you wouldn't like McCaffrey and like Mahomes, you wouldn't talk to them exactly the same way because they're completely different people. And the way to get the best out of them is completely different. So it's exactly the same with drivers, whether it's dry, whether it's wet. And some drivers really enjoy giving a lot of feedback in that scenario, really want to be connected to the decision. Others just want to be left alone to drive. And actually, as a team, understanding that, you know, like understanding what's the best way of working helps you make better decisions when you're actually in it.
The data that you get, I always think about that, especially now you have so many streams coming in. It's almost like you're getting the heartbeat. You're getting this incredible insight into what your driver is doing in the car. Even when I compare myself to another teammate who was faster, you'd see and you'd have, oh, I'm quicker in the slow corners, and you'd take that, right? But you'd see just the throttle trace and the braking and the steering inputs, everything they do with the car. It is the most insightful thing. It is like a cardiogram or whatever you call it, right? For your heart. As in your role, can you see, as you're so studying it, and you've spent so much time on the simulator, you've spent so much time in testing, and you know what your driver does, are you able to almost feel what they're doing in the car? I've never thought about it from that point of view, but you have that data. It is an insight into what they're doing as a man in the machine. Tell me about that connection and what you're able to see and feel.
Yeah, definitely. Also, women in machine, because we get in.
Sorry, no, of course
we.
Yeah, no, I was only thinking about it.
Yeah,
no,
we can see. Yeah, exactly that. You can really see drivers' strengths and car's strength, which kind of add and minus together. So sometimes, say for example, you'll get like a double effect. So like the McLaren historically was really good in high speed. Lando historically is very good in high speed. So you get like a bit of a multiplier effect. Mm. Then you've got like, you know, Lewis is in phenomenal at braking. And so like his braking point, like if suddenly the Mercedes is braking earlier than an equivalent car, you go, okay, well, it's the car, not him, because I know from previous years that that's there. Certain drivers love understeery cars. Certain drivers hate them. Max is allergic to understeer. If you ever like, you know... So you give him an understeery car and he'll hate it. Whereas like he can drive an incredibly V-style car, which when it's all set up, gives you like these phenomenally fast lap times. Daniel Ricciardo really likes a V-style car as well. And then you actually saw when he left Red Bull, that's a real pointy car, you know, you throw it into the entries and exits, and went to like kind of the Alpine, or it's called a Renault back then, car that was a lot more, you know, kind of, don't want to call it tank-like, but you know, you couldn't drive it that V-style-y. Actually he was slower than really he should have been because it just didn't really suit his driving style. So there's a lot in that. Obviously drivers have some control over setup over years. Sometimes they have some input on, you know, car development, but it does also really depend on what team you're in and if they're able to like even provide, you know, like everybody knows that Lewis, you know, he's been quite vocal in the press, like in terms of where he wanted, like kind of the seat position and the center of gravity in that Mercedes. And they haven't really been able to produce that for him like they did in the cars up to 2021 for a couple of years, just because they've had other constraints that they couldn't do. So yeah, it is huge. I mean, you kind of, when you're watching a B car, which is what we call, so the velocity of the car trace, or like a throttle trace, or even a brake trace, you obviously you see it before you're like, oh, he's going to complain about this. Usually. Or every now and again, you're like, oh, that was a good lap. But yeah, most of the time you're seeing it and you're like, oh, that car looks really difficult to drive. So yeah, and we've now actually started putting those out on F1 TV. So we kind of have put them out on F1 socials. We do put a comparison between the upgraded Mercedes and the Red Bull on the podium in Spain. So now at least people at home can also geek out just like the way that we do. And as you say, see the heartbeat of the car to actually really understand, you know, where drivers are winning and losing against each other, the teammates of other cars.
Yeah, no, brilliant. Thank you for that insight. So why do Ferrari suck so bad at Strat? I mean, they have some very smart people there. They're your peer group that are there. And you just go, no. I mean, I'm sort of a moron sitting at home with I have a very small memory stick in here. But, you know, he won Monaco. It was elated. I thought, okay, he's got that winning taste. He's just going to go. And then it's been dismal. And then they compound it with absolutely crappy calls in the pit lane. How does it defy belief to you, or what's happening there?
I'm just going to say no comment.
Yeah,
on that
exactly.
One. But what a great win it was in Monaco.
Yeah.
It was real special. After 13 years working in teams where during the races, you've never been allowed to kind of feel anything because, you know, you do a worse job of your job. And obviously you don't have things like emotive commentary.
Yeah.
So special to watch Charles win at home in Monaco, you know, after the promise that he made to his dad on his dad's deathbed all those years ago. So that got me. And then Lewis got me. So I say Max will make me cry in Zandvoort, and then I've got like the whole set. I've just turned into like a massive blubber.
Nicely deflected there, Ruth. We'll have to have a drink. When you're in Vegas,
strategist.
When we're in Vegas, you're a strategist. We can discuss it. I will, meanwhile, go on my merry way. It was my dad raced for Ferrari in Formula One in 1970 and sports cars in 1969. And he'll say certain elements haven't changed. It's just what makes them so special.
Yeah.
It's what makes them so special. Here's a question for you. Double stacking, and it's something that we saw incredibly critical to the race on Sunday, and obviously Mercedes pulled it off. It did cost George Russell a bit of time when he came in, but then they obviously kept Piastri out, which was disastrous, as you just explained. Can you just break down what goes on for those mechanics, men and women, as they come in, and for you strategists, the intensity of a double stack? I know you practice it. And it doesn't come up very often, but it is maybe the ultimate execution of all the elements of a team, as far as I can see.
Yeah, I would completely agree. I mean, you know, normally there's 22 individuals involved in a Formula One pit stop. And, you know, if any one individual, including the driver, like does this an optimal thing, that's going to show in the lap times. So a double stop, people use a different word. Actually, the Ferrari word is my favorite. They call it a doppio, which I think is phenomenal. It's just so much better, isn't it, than double stop?
It is, yeah.
But yeah, so when you have a double stop, technically, it's only a double stop. I like to only call it a double stop if you're within 8 seconds, i.e. your second car is affected. Because if your two cars are 30 seconds apart, even if you box on the same lap, you can actually completely reset the stop and then do another stop. So they're kind of like two singles in quick succession.
Yeah.
But a double stop is one where you will run out and you'll have two sets of tires waiting. So you need to take, you know, the full set, first set of tires off, jack the car up, then the second set of tires off, and then, you know, vice versa. And it is, you know, it's a real tricky one for everybody, like both from, so if your cars are running like very, very close together, so let's say they're like right next to each other, so there's maybe a second, you will try as a team to open that gap up as much as you can in some kind of like a safety car scenario, because that time's for free. If it's racing, obviously you've just got a queue. But most of the time, these double stop situations happen either under like safety cars or under like crossover conditions where you kind of have to come in. So it's kind of a frying pan or a much bigger fire situation, i.e. the second car. We spoke about it right at the very beginning of the race that we're saying, you know, actually having Max as the single one is nicer in some ways. Yeah. Because like they don't ever have to worry about the double stop. Whereas like if it is on the crossover and it's a really aggressive crossover, you have to go and you have to trade off the number of seconds you're going to lose versus staying out and going around. And most of the time in wet, you just have to take the hit, which is why we kind of were talking about the fact that they were going to have to double stop, because you just kind of, you know, normally things when they happen too fast in wet to like send it round for another lap. Unless, of course, you gamble with the second car and kind of go one lap a little bit too early, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But you can't really go on the lap and the lap after, as you saw, you can lose a lot of time. So yeah, there's just a lot more things that can go wrong. So one, every single millisecond counts because you've got another guy queuing. You've also got traffic. So actually Silverstone is quite an easy one because it's a really long, lovely pit lane. We go somewhere like Zandvoort, for example. If you try and double stop in Zandvoort, it actually blocks another guy in the team next to you from getting in because there physically isn't enough space. Also in terms of the way that the jacks, so the front jacks, the rear jacks reset, some of them are hydraulic, some of the kind of smaller teams, it actually takes some time for them to like, you know, reset.
Drop
down. And so sometimes you end up having, sometimes you actually have to physically do the second one with like a backup jack. And like, you know, just the guys that are doing this is sometimes, you know, people at home think that's their only job. They're the ones building the cars. You know, there's probably like the IT guy. There's probably like, you know, they have other jobs as well as doing these pit stops. And, you know, the amount of work they put into them, the amount of pressure they do it. You know, obviously all the guys that do it because they love it and they enjoy the pressure of it, just like we do on the pit wall in strategy, even though others less physical, more mental. But yeah, you can't say enough good things about, you know, just how these kind of like tire changes get to be, you know, the rock stars of the show, and as they should. And as you say, like every single millisecond really makes a difference. And also, you kind of just give it to them, haven't you? Impressive it is.
I love it. It is so impressive. And you can see the effect for a driver to pick a second up on track takes a lot of effort. And as you saw when Lewis came out in front of Norris, you're like, I mean, was it Piastri or not? Well, you know, whenever he made his stop and he clears him, it totally changed his race. It totally changed his race. So I always think that when reminds me of a pit stop I did at one time. I just thought this guy was the truck driver. He picked me up, you know, from the airport. He was just the truck driver until I came in for a race championship winning pit stop. And I realized that he's the guy on the fuel, you know, and you go, oh my God, that's why everybody has to work as a team and some do it better than others. Talk quickly about your, as you said, it is a family that travels as a circus, which means everybody in the paddock generally knows everything that's going on, don't they? They feel the energy shift from week to week. There's a lot of movement in the pit lane. I mean, Aston, so good last year, then so bad, you know, poor at the beginning of the year, coming good this weekend, Haas having some great results. Can you just feel as you walk up and down, especially now in your observing job, can you feel the different energy of the teams, literally every team constituent getting more excited or getting more depressed as the season goes on? Because everything that happens affects everybody, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And like, so if you do all of the races, as I did for kind of like, nearly a decade, you're spending 6 months away together. So like, it's like you're living with these people, you know, like it's like basically like a weird dysfunctional family where like family is a bit good way, you know, like you have to love each other even if you don't like each other. It's the way most people are in a Formula One team. But yeah, you're kind of having pretty much three meals a day. You all stay in the same hotel, you like go in the same cars to track and stuff like that. So, you know, it is tough. You know, like obviously everybody's very grateful to be in Formula One. It's a fantastic job, but it isn't like, you know, all glamour and champagne and yachts. A lot of the time it's kind of like long weeks away from home. And as you say, when you're having bad results, or you're kind of like not at the point that you're expecting, that makes it even harder. You know, it's really easy to kind of, you know, kind of like pick yourself up and go to the next race if you've just won, or you've got points. If you're a midfield team, it's harder, you know, to kind of like reset and go again. Like maybe it's your kind of third week away from your family. if you've had three rubbishy races on a go, and you know, just because you're 20th or first, you have to spend the same amount of time as track, so you don't really get any kind of, like, you know, let up. So I think it's definitely kind of, yeah, it's a circus, I would say. Like, yeah,
it's a
very
circus.
Much traveling circus.
Everybody's in it.
Yeah.
So the rest of the season, we're at the halfway point pretty much. It is maybe the most exciting we've had in recent memory. There's so many parts to it. But for people at home, it's very easy. And I find myself falling into this, oh my God, that car is so crappy. Oh my God, they're so far off. And then you remember, especially I think when you look at like the Red Bull Ring and you realize that 20 cars separated by just under four tenths of a second, can you put into layman's terms in a way that how small that gap is from that top team at Red Bull and McLaren to the team running at the back of the grid, you know, to a Williams or someone right at the back, unfortunately, at the moment? It isn't a country mile, is it? It is in results, but it isn't in terms of physics and math.
Yeah, so that kind of the Austria example in Q1, the difference between P1 and P20 was 0.798 seconds, which is the smallest gap we've ever had in history, which is, you know, basically 1%, you know, in terms of from the winner to the loser, as it were. Typically, the whole, like right now, the whole kind of pack is covered within 2%. So even in a non-typical, like wet is a bit different because the track dominates it. So we tend to put wet in a separate bucket because that's kind of the track conditions, as we said, wildly fluctuates. But in dry running, if you're just talking about like the raw performance of the car, you know, the whole field is often within 2%, 2.5%. If you're like three lapping on your own at the back, and like if you imagine that in like a road car, like would you like not pick a car over like 1.5% difference? You probably would just like kind of like flick through the stats and like not even be bothered by that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is phenomenal. And you know, these upgrades that are doing the ebb and the flow between, you know, like the Mercedes one, I think, is a really good example. They brought their new front wing concept, changed some other parts in the car, but that package was actually 0.3, 0.4%, depends a bit on the track, but that's not a lot, but that's gone from basically kind of, you know, them lapping around in P5, P6, and us or even lower, and us talking about them, Ferrari, McLaren, and, you know, Red Bull, to them being on the top step. So it's tiny margins, which is so exciting for us at home. And as you say, it's also nice for people in the sport to know that, like, you know, there's hope. Even if you're like, keep going, because, you know, like you're one upgrade package away from completely changing your situation, whether at the front or whether at the back. You know, if you look at the Haas, for example, they celebrated their 4th of July weekend, UHASE, with another like P6. Scored in Austria, they scored more points in one weekend than they did in the entire 2023 season. And now they've just doubled it pretty much. So yeah, it's, I think it's really exciting. And I think that's where it should be. You know, I had the pleasure of going to the Indy 500 this year. So I was there for the full 2 weeks. And you know, how great the racing is when the cars are so close together. So like, I like it. I think it's good for the sport that we have a tight field. It makes it more interesting.
Yeah, beautifully said. So let's talk about women in Formula One. Obviously, there's you, there's all the other engineers, there's strategists, there's mechanics. I see, you know, unfortunately, as a spectator through the TV, you don't get to know any of those personalities. And you go, oh, wow, you know, until they take the helmet off, you don't realize it's a girl. But obviously, in the IMSA series and IndyCar, which I'm much more in contact with, you know, personally, you see so many people coming up. And even my daughter, she's 17, having a conversation with her the other day about everyone thinks they have to be a driver, but there are so many ways to get into the brilliant world of motorsports as a woman. And I know you're now a role model for that, probably a role you take very seriously, but what are the questions you get asked and what is the kind of advice you give?
Well, the standard one is how do you get into, you know, Formula One or motorsports? And, you know, in terms of like, I'm not an expert when it comes to like other other areas, when it comes to an engineer, like, you know, the biggest thing is STEM subjects. And so you kind of, your math, singular. I know now you don't say maths. your math, your physics, your, you know, your sciences and stuff like that. And making sure that, you know, when it comes to like picking your, you know, whether it's UK's options, whether it's picking your major, you know, that you're like focusing on a degree that's going to actually like help you. The other one that we have is the Formula Student Program, which I think is absolutely amazing. I was part of my Formula Student team. We were terrible. We were like Hesketh without the wing. We were like, everyone thought we would be amazing because we were like Cambridge and we were rubbish. We constantly had help from other like FSAE teams. Like I remember Michigan helped us out loads because we didn't, couldn't afford a second diff and they like dusted one off and gave us a spare one. But stuff like that, that's, you know, if you're when you're at a college or a university, that's kind of like free to get involved in, it's so great because, you know, not all of us have access to, you know, kind of like practical motorsport growing up. You know, both my parents were doctors and we lived in central London. So like I was never going to be building a car in my non-existent garage or going and like karting or like learning stuff about it. So I think there's so many different forms of motorsport. And I think, you know, especially, you know, like there is Formula One and Formula One is brilliant. But there's so many other brilliant forms of motorsport as well. And actually getting involved in any form of motorsport. You know, you mentioned IMSA and IndyCar. You know, like I've gone the other way around. I've looked at IndyCar strategy after I've looked at F1 strategy, and like the nuances are different, like in terms of your first order effect, rather than it being like tires and pace, you know, it's fuel, but physics is physics. And if you know, like, you know, racing one side, you know, racing the other side, like look at Carl Larson, like jumps into an IndyCar and suddenly he's like, oh, his was the coolest man alive, but like suddenly like really, really doing well. So I think getting involved in any kind of motorsport you can, and then if you're kind of going on the engineering route, making sure that you you kind of focus on those STEM-based subjects, and then just get used to the word no, and that like no actually means not yet. And every single person, like from Max Verstappen to, you know, Lewis Hamilton to like Ross Brawn and Adrian Newey to like every single one of us has been told no, we don't want you, many times in our career, because you only need like one yes for it to like, you know, change your life. Got that from Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, but but yeah, but the reality is that like you have to fail to succeed, and don't, like, you know, don't ever be put off by, you know, applying for 20 things and getting all 20 no's. Like if you were told after 100 no's you get a yes, you just keep going, cracking through them. So that would be my other piece of advice.
I love that. Thank you so much. But also, we are on the cusp of having a female driver breakthrough to Formula One. Look at the talent that we're seeing in the feeder series. I mean, legitimate.
Jamie,
right? I mean, just, there's Bianca, there's all these girls that are just so poised. And for the first time in history, they've had the background, the training, the support. You know, there's this, now we have social media behind them. It's a very exciting moment. I mean, it's hard to say who's going to pop through, right? But it is the perfect ingredients for that to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the number of failed racing drivers, the number of kids that tried karting versus the number of people that got into Formula One, like probably that's a ratio of like 1,000 to 1, maybe. Like, you
maybe
know,
more.
Kids that kind of started karting versus people, maybe more. And now, if you say that's kind of like a random distribution, I'm a geek, but, you know, I've never seen anything that says that, like there's anything specific. If one of those people or two of them is a girl, the chances that like that one is going to end up in Formula One is like only 0.2%. Whereas if it's 50-50, the chances that it funnels into being there, and I think that's what it is, it's a grassroots situation. It's like basically saying, we would love to have people from different sports, from different genders and different backgrounds come in. If you look at the like the makeup of the F1 grid, you know, it was back in, we were looking at the stats this weekend, and like in 1968 was the last time we had like 3 Brits on the grid, and that was when there was like 15 of us, and we still weren't particularly good back then. We're still getting beaten by Italians, and like now we've let in all the other countries. No wonder it's the first time ever that we've ended up with 3 Brits on the on the front row of Silverstone, because, you know, the chances that the best person just comes from one country or one gender or one socioeconomic background is just statistically pretty small. So I think that's what it's about, is making sure that dads and mums bring their little boys and little girls karting, that we kind of, you know, give people the best opportunity. And I think medicine's a great example of this, that a generation ago, where people like my parents went to university, it was 10 to 1. So 10 to 1 in terms of like women versus men. And then doctors were 10 to 1. Shocker that. Mm. Now it's 50-50 at both university and in terms of the thing. So it's just about making sure that you have that like representation. And I think it's coming, but I don't think it's going to come until we actually, you know, really make sure we try and find the talent that's out there and nurture it from, you know, from an early age.
Well, thank you for that insight. I love the way you talk because you're a very emotional person as well. I can see that. And you're passionate, but your brilliant brain is also making things logical. Whereas the rest of us just...
Can you tell I play a lot of poker? I play very tight.
Oh, I would hate to... I'm going to watch you when you come to Vegas. I'm going to stand behind you just
going,
I'm
with her. It's actually the same maths as strategy.
Really?
Actually the same maths as strategy. And I used to spend all my summer shutdowns in Vegas because it was a way to supplement my very small graduate career because it's exactly the same maths as what you do for race strategy. So very fond of Vegas from the beginning. I told Stefano we should have a race there in 2013. Well, I'm not going to claim it was all me, but I'm claiming a small part of it.
I think you should. We're just going to have to get a disguise for you now you're becoming famous. It's now time for
sparkly jacket.
Sparkly jacket and big glasses. There you are. It's now time for the Mobile One pit stop for the love of driving. Just a few quick questions here, Ruth. The most stupid thing a man has said to you when you say you will work in Formula One, because men can be pretty dumb. What is the most dumb thing a man said to you?
Do you know what DRS is? And I actually wrote a thesis on DRS with Charlie Whiting.
Boom, mic drop. You're out of there. What driver would you love to have worked with that you didn't?
Senna.
Oh, absolutely. Has a driver ever shouted at you during a race for a bad call or didn't agree with you?
Yeah, all the time. Like, happens all the time. I've shouted at them. I just don't have a button to them. it's like a family. You argue and then you're better for it. Like, you know, think we're family, not friends. It's what families do. You say, like, argue to come back together, to come closer in the long run.
They say you shouldn't meet your heroes, but obviously you are meeting your heroes. Who was the driver that particularly you had a fangirl moment over?
Wasn't a driver. It was Ross Brawn. So Ross Brawn was my engineering hero growing up. And genuinely probably the only person I was ever like starstruck when they like knew who I was the first time he sent me an email and I printed it out.
I like that. Now, when you race with a team or work with a team, you eat and drink with that one team. But when you do PR and media, you can go anywhere. Best food in the paddock.
Oh, I'm still trying them out because I've only been there since Miami. But I have to say, Red Bull, very good. Very, very good. And what else? I had a really great iced coffee from Williams. I'll have to get back to you. I haven't done them all yet.
You see, now you've got a new task from me. And do you feel you have any unfinished business on the pit wall in Formula One?
Ooh, good question. I think, yeah, if there was, if the right opportunity came up, I could go back onto a pit wall. But it would have to be, you know, for something that was worth leaving the Formula One family for, which I'm very happy at. So yeah, never say never, as they always say in Formula One.
Well, thank you, Ruth. That was great. Mobile One pit stop for the love of driving. Ruth, the other thing about you going back on the pit wall is that you're now able to wear all these really fun clothes that I can see is in your wardrobe.
It's a nightmare.
Is that the biggest worry, right? That is your biggest.
It's terrible. I've literally never had to dress myself my entire life. Like, all I've had is team kit. This is an awful thing. Like, and now suddenly, like, honestly, I feel so sorry for all these type of people that have to do it all the time. Like, you have to think about what shoes you have. There's different rules about what shoes you're allowed to wear. And then you got to think about belts for, like, packs. You got to, like, give me team kit any day. I was like, can I just wear some F1 team kit? Yeah, it's not for me.
That's so funny you should say that, because it is true. A uniform, and I bet your closets are just full, like mine are, of team jackets and all this gear.
Yeah.
It's the sort of the curse of the job, but it does make it easy, doesn't it? You just have to pack one set of stuff.
Yeah, no, I really like the getting up. You just bring everything to every race, put it in laundry, get it back. Yeah, that's actually been one of the toughest learning curves.
Yeah. Well, the next time I see you in person, we'll be here in Las Vegas. Just, you said before we came on air how great it was last year. What are your sort of forecasts for this year coming up? Because I think it's going to be better.
Well, statistically, the second race at a track is always a phenomenal one. And that's because, you know, if you've been to somewhere like Silverstone, teams have been there loads and loads and loads of times. The second time you go to a race, you have to decide whether or not you want to base your decisions when it comes to setup, when it comes to strategy, when it comes to qualifying and everything on what you're seeing right now or what you saw last time. And it's teams often take really varying approaches as to how much they want to bias on historical data versus what they're seeing right now, which often means you get like a big split. I think the layout of Vegas is absolutely phenomenal for racing. I think you're going to have overtakes, you're going to have everything, you're going to have different strategies. And I mean, I miss the Sphere, like that. I got so emotional, I had to say goodbye to him. Like he'll be there giving his little sassy eye for the whole time. And yeah, I'm absolutely convinced it'll be race of the year, but I am biased because it is my favorite race, but I will also say it's the best race.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you for saying that. Oh, quickly before I let you go, because I know it's Tuesday night with you and you've only just really had some time at home. We have Hungary coming up. This time last year, I didn't even have to predict what I could predict what the race result was going to be. It's not that easy, is it? I wouldn't, as a betting man, I don't know what I'd bet. What would you bet? I mean, for the podium in Hungary.
Well, it is. You think basically the trick to betting is to wait till FP2. So that's the insider, is that like the bets don't shut. So once you see an FP2, it's much more sensible. But because people could be bringing upgrades and the gaps between the cars are so small that actually that could also make a difference. But on paper, as you say, it's wide open because Budapest has got lots of low speed corners. It's really like narrow track. It's also one that Lewis is pretty good at. And it's one where you have to ride a lot of curbs. So it could be a bit like the Canada race where we ended up with kind of three teams, at least at the moment, unless Ferrari bring an upgrade, like both the Red Bull that will probably be fast at some areas of the track, but not so much fast to do the curbs because the RB20 doesn't like curbs. The McLaren is probably a bit of an all-rounder. And then the Mercedes that's like got this like phenomenal kind of upgrade that's really put them really good on the braking and in the low-speed corners. So yeah, I mean, I think after Silverstone, don't bet against Lewis Hamilton to like come back and do it again. But we'll have to see whether or not that Red Bull has kind of like unlocked the pace that it's actually got. And then, yeah, you can't discount McLaren. And then maybe Ferrari will come back to the party. But yeah, I think it's going to be an amazing race. It's always a good strategy race as well, which is why I like it.
Perfect. Just even hearing you talk there, that's exactly it. There is no clear, defined winner going into the next race in a couple of weeks. Enjoy the break, Ruth. Thanks so much for being on the show. This was a real blast. Well, watching that race at Silverstone made me feel all speedy. But you know what? You don't need to go 200 miles an hour to outrun your inbox or pull multiple Gs around corners just to decline a phone call. You don't have to have someone waving a yellow flag to tell you to slow down and look around. Basically, you don't have to be a professional driver to disconnect and break free. All you have to do is drive. Mobile One, for the love of driving. Visit loveofdriving.us/drive to win to learn some more. Well, what an insightful interview. And she's just as cool as I thought she might be. But it's a 2-week break before the Formula One circus heads over to Hungary. And that is a track around the Hungaroring that was dominated in 1986 by Nelson Piquet when he won the first Formula One race. Wow, how times have changed since then. That was a famous battle between him in the Williams and Ayrton Senna in the Lotus, and it was one of those epics that Formula One fans of the decade will always list as one of their favorite races. It is a track where it gets hot, 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 so Tyre Deg will be a big part of it. We heard from Ruth how she's going to forecast on what the actual dynamics of the tracks are. But it does sound like it's going to suit each car in a different sector. Last year, the top five was Max, Norris, Perez, that ain't going to happen, Hamilton, and Piastri. So you could see there were dynamics at play that were bringing the people that are now consistent front runners. They were showing their pace there last year. So I think that supports and backs up what Ruth was saying about it going to be a barnstormer of a race. The top Red Bull teams have got to rise to the challenge. As I said, it's a wake-up call on consistency. You have to deliver and not make mistakes. So Red Bull arrive every weekend with deadly intent, and that is what everyone else is going to have to bring. So it's going to be very, very exciting to watch. Can't wait. Well, everybody, enjoy your weekend off from Formula One. If you're into tennis, you've got Wimbledon. Lots of stuff happening. See you in 2 weeks' time. I can't wait. Stay in touch on social media. A big thanks to Ruth for joining me on the show. Huge thanks to the Wynn Las Vegas for being such gracious hosts. And of course, to Mobile One for the love of driving. See you soon.